It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear about why we fly flags at half staff and some of the history behind the practice. First, it's time for a look at some of the top stories in national politics in the last week. The Trump administration is rolling back guidelines on using affirmative action for college admissions. U.S. and Canadian officials are getting ready for what could be a tense series of negotiations on NAFTA. And some Democrats are embracing a plan to abolish or reorganize Immigration and Customs Enforcement, otherwise known as ICE. And our question for you this week is, what do you think about the back-and-forth tariffs between the U.S. and Canada? Are you worried about the impact the dispute could have on the industry you work in? Do you think President Trump's decisions could give the U.S. more leverage in making a new NAFTA deal? Do you have questions about how this is playing out in Washington or in Canada? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Adrian Morrow is the U.S. correspondent for the Canadian newspaper The Globe and Mail. He's based in Washington. Adrian, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, yesterday, the Education and Justice Departments announced they were abandoning the Obama administration's guidelines of affirmative action in college admissions. What reasoning did they give for that decision?
Essentially, their reasoning is that they think affirmative action is discriminatory against white people, and that that they basically believe that that the colleges and universities and other schools should be admitting students purely based on other factors such as academics, that they shouldn't sort of use race at all as a filter. So it's sort of the classic debate that I guess you get between the left and right on affirmative action, where to the of course to the left, they sort of see this as correcting the kind of implicit biases and structural racism that you have in education institutions by making race one potential criteria of admission. To the right, they basically just see that as discrimination against white people, and believe that that it should sort of have no factor at all in admissions.
So the Obama administration issued these as guidelines, not changes to the law. What specifically did those guidelines say?
What they did was they kind of encouraged education institutions to incorporate race into their admissions criteria, and basically kind of explained to them how to do it in such a way that it wouldn't violate court rulings, because there have been a number of Supreme Court cases that have kind of set the guidelines around affirmative action. So so the bottom line essentially is that they say you can't impose quotas or sort of hard numbers on students of particular races. However, you can incorporate it into your decision making and say that's sort of one criteria out of many that you will use when evaluating individual students that you want to take in. And so the Obama administration had sort of written guidelines to kind of explain that to education institutions and gave them kind of a sense of, if you want to do this, and we encourage you to do this, here's how you would go about it. And so by sort of rescinding that, the Trump administration is basically saying, we're not going to give you, any kind of guidance on how to make this work. And maybe further than that, I mean, we're basically not going to encourage you to do it anymore. So if you do it, then, there may be, I think the sort of implication is that there may be, there are other repercussions or that may not sort of stand you in good stead with the administration.
So that was actually what I was going to ask next, Adrian. So these were guidelines. It was not law. They are rolling back the guidelines. But it does sound like if there are individual institutions that decide to continue using affirmative action, this is kind of a shot over the bow saying you might face lawsuits from students who feel they've been discriminated against, or I'm assuming that there's money flowing from the education department to some of these institutions that might be in jeopardy if the administration chose to do so.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the thing is that they haven't actually promulgated their own guidelines. They just sort of repealed the Obama-era ones, but they haven't kind of written their own, set out in black and white, kind of, here's what we want, we want to see from you, or here's, saying, don't do this. However, the fact that they have rescinded those guidelines, I think that's kind of the implication, that they basically said, if you are, you do face lawsuits, we're not necessarily going to have your back, and if you're, looking for funding from us, or, you want our help with something, you may not get it, because I think that's sort of the implication, because, these are not sort of these aren't the guidelines anymore. This isn't sort of something that we agree with. So there's no sort of explicit order from the Trump administration, I guess, here saying, you can't do this anymore. However, I think that the implication is very much there.
Certainly, issues of affirmative action being put into practice have ended up in front of courts and the U.S. Supreme Court. And here we are with the announced retirement of Justice Anthony Kennedy leaving the court at the end of this month. Do you think that the timing of this decision on these affirmative action guidelines is related to the fact that President Trump will be appointing another Supreme Court justice?
It could be. I mean, the fact that these guidelines have kind of been taken out of the way, it kind of it removes, you know, maybe one more sort of legal fallback that some universities might have when they face these kinds of cases. And there are some cases working their way through the system now, you know, sort of dealing with people kind of challenging affirmative action statutes. So I think sort of taking these guidelines down, you know, sort of takes away one little piece of cover that I guess these universities have, so that if it does come, you know, a year from now, say when there's a more conservative leaning Supreme Court, if one of these cases does come before the Supreme Court, it kind of removes one, you know, one sort of thing that I suppose universities could kind of point to when they, you know, when they litigate these cases and say, you know, here's the guidance we were given by the administration, and so we were sort of following what the administration wanted. You know, without having that guidance, that gives them, you know, another, you know, sort of, I guess, takes away another sort of argument that they could use, you know, when one of these cases comes forward. So it very well could be, you know, the timing, you know, could be related, but it's certainly relevant. You know, the fact that this won't be there, I think, is going to, you know, hurt their cases if and when it does come back to the Supreme Court.
We're talking with Adrian Morrow right now. He's the U.S. correspondent for the Canadian newspaper, The Globe and Mail. We're taking a look at some of the biggest news stories out of Washington in the past week. And Adrian, I'm especially happy to have you today because U.S.-Canadian relations have been in the news a lot. So it's great to have your perspective. What?
Perhaps the first time ever.
Well, it's certainly an interesting time in relations between what are usually two extremely close allies. So trade tensions have been very high, as we know, between the U.S. and Canada lately. After President Trump first put tariffs in place on imported steel and aluminum, Canada then responded this week. If I remember correctly, it was actually on Canada Day, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm, that's
okay.
Right.
I thought so. And all of this is coming as negotiations for a renewal of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, gets underway. Here's President Trump talking on Fox News about his thoughts on the deal.
NAFTA, I could sign it tomorrow, but I'm not happy with it. I want to make it more fair, okay?
You can't do NAFTA before the midterms.
I want to wait till after the election.
Adrian, do we know what President Trump specifically is looking for in a new NAFTA deal? I mean, he said over and over that it's a bad deal, he doesn't like it, but what is he looking to change in it?
Basically, he wants Canada and Mexico to lower all their trade barriers while the U.S. raises its trade barriers. That's sort of the bottom line. So, for instance, one of the things he wants from Canada is for Canada to get rid of its system of supply management, which is basically it's sort of a cartel arrangement for the dairy system in Canada. And part of that is that, you know, over a certain amount, all sort of imported dairy has to pay a massive tariff, you know, when it comes into Canada. So he wants Canada to get rid of that, to sort of get rid of one of the last. It's one of the, you know, I think something like 97 or 98% of goods between the three countries are tariff-free, and that's one of the 2 or 3% that isn't. So he basically wants to get rid of that. But then at the same time, he wants the U.S. to erect more trade barriers to Canada and Mexico. So, for instance, he wants on the Canadian side, he wants new procurement rules that would basically cap the amount of U.S. government contracts that Canadian companies are allowed to bid on. He also wants to get rid of Chapter 19, which is a dispute resolution mechanism that Canada has used successfully in the past to kind of challenge tariffs from the United States. He wants to get rid of that. And then on the Mexican side, probably his most serious demand is that he wants a bunch of changes to the auto sector that would essentially have the effect of moving or encouraging auto jobs to come to the U.S. and not to Mexico. So specifically, he basically wants a wage threshold that would ensure that a certain percentage of all the components to cars are made in factories where workers are making about, say, at least you know, the equivalent of U.S. $16 an hour. So because the average auto worker wage in Mexico is, you know, is the equivalent of about U.S. $4 an hour, that would sort of take away one of the advantages that Mexico has in attracting you know, auto workers, so auto jobs. So essentially that's kind of the rubric of it, where, you know, Trump has basically a list of demands that would impose kind of you know, new protectionism on Canada and Mexico while sort of forcing Canada and Mexico to lower their trade barriers to the U.S.
It is interesting because the newly elected president of Mexico, López Obrador, wants to raise those wages in the Mexican auto factory. So it sounds like that's something that would make President Trump happy.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he and people on the left in Mexico actually do argue in favor of higher wages in the auto sector. What's not clear to me is if they'd actually want to raise them as high as Trump is proposing. I mean, you know, it's one thing to go from, say, $4 an hour to $8 an hour or $7 an hour or something, but to go all the way to 16, you know, I'm not sure if that's exactly what he's contemplating. However, he has been much more, receptive, I guess, to those sorts of arguments than the current administration. And the other thing that kind of gives the Trump administration some hope, I guess, that López Obrador is going to be kind of easier to deal with in Mexico, is that he's really not, I mean, he's a populist, you know, leftist politician who's not, connected to the kind of multinational corporations or to the American corporations that have so much influence with the current government in Mexico. And so I think they basically feel, a lot of people in the Trump administration feel that the current government in Mexico is largely being kind of, driven along quite a bit by the multinational corporations and these kind of big corporate interests that, of course, don't want anything to change in NAFTA and sort of like the system the way it is. And so I think they're hopeful that with López Obrador in there, he's going to be his own man and is basically going to, you know, be more willing to agree to things, based on their own merits or whatever merits they can sell them on, rather than sort of, you know, doing the bidding of the auto companies, which basically don't want any of these rules to come in.
Let's talk about the countermeasures that Canada put in place a few days ago in response to the tariffs on imported steel and aluminum that the Trump administration put in place. What specifically are those countermeasures?
So basically, Canada's imposed dollar-for-dollar tariffs on the U.S. So they calculated that it's about $16.6 billion worth of Canadian steel and aluminum that gets exported to the U.S. every year. So they put tariffs on $16.6 billion Canadian. I'm not working out the math in my head of what that is in U.S. dollars, but they worked in. So they basically put tariffs on $16.6 billion worth of U.S. Imports to Canada. And so that covers steel and aluminum, but because there's a large trade surplus in aluminum on Canada, on Canada's side, they basically imposed tariffs on a bunch of other consumer goods as well to get to that $16.6 billion total. And so the other goods that they put tariffs on are all picked for purely political reasons. So, Kentucky bourbon, because it comes from Mitch McConnell's state. Frozen pizzas, because I guess there's a big cluster of frozen pizza factories in Wisconsin, and so they want to influence Paul Ryan that way. Chocolate, because it comes from Pennsylvania, which is a key swing state for President Trump. And so basically I think what their hope is that they can basically put pressure on these, key politicians or sort of key constituencies that have some influence with Donald Trump, and then get them to put pressure on Trump to ease off on Canada.
What's the mood among Canadian politicians and Canadians right now about the U.S. tariffs?
I think there's a certain amount of anger and disappointment. I mean, there's a good number of Canadians who've we've talked about boycotting U.S. products themselves or refusing to go on holiday in the U.S. this year. So I think there is a certain amount of irritation among Canadians. The Canadian government is interesting in that they've kind of had to play a bit of a double game. Where on one hand, they don't want to do anything to unnecessarily anger Trump because they know that if they unnecessarily are seen to provoke Trump and something really bad happens, either there are more tariffs slapped on or NAFTA gets torn up or something, they don't want to get blamed by the Canadian business community for sort of blowing it, I guess. But at the same time, they sort of have to be tough to, both because I think they think that Trump probably respects that more than if they just sort of rolled over for him. But also because I think for domestic political purposes, they have to be able to show the Canadian public that they're doing something, that they're standing up to the guy. So you've seen sort of a bit of a dual message from the Trudeau government where, about half the time they come out swinging and they're pretty, fixed and firm in what they say about Donald Trump, and then the other half of the time they kind of tiptoe around him and are kind of careful not to really go over the top in what they say about him. So it's really a balancing act for Trudeau.
We're talking with Adrian Morrow of the Globe and Mail out of Canada about the week's top news in Washington, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Our question for you this week: how do you feel about the tariffs and counter tariffs between the U.S. and Canada? Are you worried about creating tension with our near neighbors? Do you think the hard line could lead to the U.S. getting more out of a new NAFTA deal? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with Adrian Morrow. He's U.S. correspondent for the Globe and Mail, looking at the week's top political stories. And Adrian, let's move on to calls to abolish ICE. There's been a push lately from progressives and some Democratic politicians to abolish U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. One of those is Wisconsin Representative Mark Pocan, who introduced a bill to do that. Here he is on Fox News explaining his support for the move.
You took 20 different agencies, put it into what was ICE after 9/11, and instead of going after terrorists, now we're going after people who get a traffic ticket. And that's, again, a violation of what ICE was about. So unfortunately, the president has so damaged right. ICE that it can't function the way right. it was intended to. And we really need those functions to happen.
So, Adrian, would you say that's typical of the reasoning that we're hearing from those who want to get rid of ICE?
Yeah, I think that notion that ICE is going after the wrong people, that that the scenes that we saw at the border from the last couple of weeks of children being separated from their families, that there is a sense from the opponents of ICE, from some people on the left, that that the agency isn't really doing what it was supposed to do initially, which was pure homeland security and securing the borders. That said, I sort of wonder whether abolishing ICE is necessarily necessarily what everybody is actually after, because presumably a lot of the functions that that ICE currently performs, whether it's going after gangsters or trying to track down terrorists and those sorts of things, I'm not sure that those sorts of functions you actually want to get rid of. And so it's not clear to me at this point whether the notion of abolishing ICE is sort of a symbolic thing of kind of just reconstituting the agency with a different mandate under a different name, or if the push really is to completely somehow get rid of this agency and start from scratch.
It seems like the Democrats see this as a really good message to push, because especially with the separations of families at the border, there has been a lot of negative feelings about ICE and what they're doing. On the other hand, President Trump has tweeted that he's going to bring up their position of wanting to abolish ICE as much as possible. He sees it as a losing prospect for Democrats. Where do you think the truth lies between the two?
Trump is certainly onto something in the sense that this is a sort of an easy play for any right-wing politician to make, where the right always wants to say that the left is soft on crime, if they're a bunch of bleeding heart liberals, and that if you left it to them, they would take away all the kind of protections that are helping enforce the law and protect the country. And so he's probably correct in the sense that he's definitely going to gin up his base by doing that, by basically making that argument. On the other side, I'm sure that there's obviously a large push among left to center Democrats, or the left in general, to do something or to take some kind of action to try to make sure that that what happened at the border in the last couple of weeks doesn't happen again. And ICE is sort of an easy target for that. What I really wonder about, though, are the independent voters or, sort of soft Democratic voters in swing states, and particularly the traditional Democratic voters who went over to Trump in the U.S. Midwest in the last election. And I wonder if, I'm sure that a lot of those people are sympathetic to the argument that, ICE's mandate needs to be changed, or that ICE shouldn't be doing some of the things that it's doing, going after, single mothers or people who haven't committed any serious crimes, or, separating children from their families. But I'm not sure that they would necessarily buy, an argument that you have to get rid of the agency entirely. And I wonder if some of those people might not be swayed by Trump's argument that, the Democrats are going way too far, and that they're basically trying to get rid of protections and law enforcement for the country, as opposed to simply reforming it.
Tomorrow at 4:30 here on Central Time, we'll be talking more about this, looking at why ICE was founded, what it does, and what abolishing or reorganizing it would take. And we'll ask for your listener opinions as well. That's tomorrow at 4:30. Let's take a call from Anne in Monona. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I had a question about our Attorney General Sessions, although he's tried to act very statesmanlike since he was appointed by Trump, and notice he's still there. He was known as one of the most viciously racist, or maybe not vicious, but certainly a racist politician on the federal level. And I wondered what part, Trump needs advice from somewhere. He was never even on a school board. So whether Sessions has had anything to do with some of these unfortunate policies that Trump, announces daily.
Thanks for that call, Anne. And it sounds like Anne is kind of saying that, the administration doesn't have a whole lot to point to as far as positive relationships with some of these communities.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly true that Jeff Sessions has been a big part of cracking down at the border and enforcing the zero tolerance directive that every person caught crossing illegally on the Texas border or on the southern border, would be prosecuted. And it's certainly, the direction to get rid of the Obama era affirmative action guidelines came in part from both the education as well as from the Justice Department that Sessions runs. So he's certainly a part of that. And I mean, Trump has always ginned up race politics. You know, I mean, from the time that he was a candidate, he ran on, attacking Muslim people and attacking Mexican migrants. And so what he's doing on the affirmative action front is fairly consistent. I mean, it's consistent with a lot of sort of previous, Republican presidents and Republican arguments, but it's also consistent with Trump's brand, basically, and targeting race politics and kind of culture war issues, because that's the kind of stuff that his base likes to hear about. You saw how well the going after black NFL players played for Donald Trump last year with his base, and I think he's trying to recreate a little bit of that same same anger, I guess, or that same approval from his base.
And Adrian, before we wrap up, I want to make sure that we talk about the shooting at the Capital Gazette newspaper in Annapolis, Maryland last week, which left five employees dead. You traveled to Annapolis and reported on the aftermath of the tragedy. What was that like?
It's a little bit surreal, whenever you're in a place that's gone through that kind of trauma, and it's particularly strange in the sense that, this mass shooting epidemic has inflicted America for years. This is the first time that it's really come to that extent to one of America's newsrooms. And so it was this kind of, surreal dynamic of, on one hand, interviewing trying to interview the people who were close to it, who themselves were also employees of the newspaper, and themselves had covered it. When I got there on Thursday night, shortly after it happened, a couple of the, or actually three of the staff members who hadn't happened to have been in the building when it happened, were across the street working out of the pickup truck of one of these guys, putting out the next day's paper, reporting on their own tragedy. So it was this very, this sort of surreal, almost meta moment, I guess, to see the people who normally cover this sort of stuff, having to deal with it at the same time as doing their jobs.
Well, and I read some comments by one of those employees, one of those journalists who was putting out the paper the next day and saying, this is what we do. This is what all of us did and what those of us who are left will continue to do. That has to be pretty powerful for a fellow journalist to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, no matter what happens, nothing's going to stop the paper from coming out. And I asked one of the guys, afterwards, sort of how long it took him to decide that this was going to happen and that he was going to make sure the paper came out, regardless of, of what had happened to his colleagues. He said about 30 seconds. It wasn't even a consideration for him. He knew that it had to get done.
Well, Adrian, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a great conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Adrian Morrow is the U.S. correspondent for the Canadian newspaper The Globe and Mail. He was with us for our look at some of the week's top news in politics. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. President Trump faced criticism after he reportedly denied a request to fly flags at half-staff to honor five newspaper employees who were shot and killed in Annapolis, Maryland last week. He changed his mind, but it's not the first time a decision to lower or not lower flags has gotten criticism. Our next guest took a closer look into when and why we lower flags. Michelle Johnson is a contributor to WisContext.org. Michelle, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So what prompted you to look into this topic?
Well, the shootings at the high schools in Florida and Texas this year really touched off not just an impassioned discussion about gun law reform, but also renewed a conversation about what flags at half staff mean in an age when they're flying at half staff more often. Some people were suggesting, even some op-ed writers suggesting, that the flag should just stay at half staff.
Mm-hmm. So who has the power to order flags to be lowered?
The president of the United States for federal facilities and naval vessels, overseas places like embassies, any place where the federal government has jurisdiction. In the state governors have the power to do that at state entities.
And
do governors take the lead from the president, or do they have some leeway where perhaps the federal flags are not being lowered for something that is national, but the governor thinks that it should be?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And in looking at governor's executive orders from really back to the Thompson administration, we found that, yes, they're taking that opportunity. And those fall into some basic categories.
What are those?
Governors definitely have the power to lower flags on state properties to half staff. They'll do it when a public official or someone who's a high-profile public person dies. They will do it when to honor a military personnel who are killed on active duty. They'll do it when a public safety officer, a firefighter, or a police officer, or a paramedic dies in the line of duty.
So I think one of the things that's a little confusing for people is we often see flags at half staff, but they're, say, in front of a car dealership or not, you know, it's in front of a business. Those flags don't fall under any of this, right? That's the decision of the person who owns that property.
Absolutely. I mean, flags are essentially covered under the First Amendment. You have the right to lower your flag to half staff on private property when you see fit. There's a lot of discussion about that, whether that's really an appropriate thing to do. But fundamentally, yes, people do have the right to lower their flags on private property. And most of the time, they want to know when is the right time to do this.
So they follow that lead.
Yeah, they absolutely do.
So talking about those official flags and the decisions made by the president and the governor, what did you in your research, Michelle, find about trends in flags being lowered in the state of Wisconsin?
Well, it was a little bit tricky because no state agency keeps comprehensive records about when and why flags fly at half staff. The governor publishes executive orders on his website, which includes flag lowering orders back to when he took office. But no state department really keeps comprehensive records. So we had to do some building and looking at records, executive orders, governor's executive orders, presidential proclamations. What we found is that in most years, flags flew at half staff more often after September 11th, 2001, than in the previous decade.
And actually, all that data of when the flags have been at half staff in Wisconsin will be available on wiscontext.org. That it's pretty interesting to see those specific examples. Michelle Johnson is a contributor to wiscontext.org. We're talking about her piece looking at when flags are lowered to half staff in Wisconsin. And Michelle, one thing that I was curious about is when did the idea of flags being lowered to half staff become a symbol of mourning?
It really becomes much more important or significant, I think, after the end of the Civil War. But the half staff flag tradition goes really as far back, at least as the 17th century. The first documented instance of it was in 1612, when the crew of a British ship lowered its flag to half mast after the captain was killed on an expedition. So the tradition came from ships at sea and then sort of migrated onto land, but it really gained significance after the end of the Civil War.
And as you said, it's really also picked up in frequency since 9/11. So there is something called the U.S. Flag Code. And what direction does that provide for presidents and governors when it comes to when to lower the flag to half staff?
Congress adopted the U.S. Flag Code in 1942, but it really, the rules were pretty loose for when and how to lower flags until 1954, when President Eisenhower signed a presidential proclamation standardizing the dates and time periods for flying the U.S. flag at half staff. So, for example, it says that flags should fly at half staff for 30 days after the death of a president or a former president, 10 days after the death of a vice president or a Supreme Court justice, retired chief justice, et cetera.
But I'm guessing if the flag code was really codified as far as the lowering part in the 50s, a lot has changed since then. We've talked now about 9/11, so acts of terrorism there. It seems like this must be, in some ways, if not a living document, living interpretation of that document.
Absolutely. That it's absolutely true. It is sort of a living document. And there's a lot of room in it for presidents, for governors, to make individual decisions about when the flag should be lowered as a symbol of mourning. Mm-hmm. After 9/11, before 9/11, Memorial Day was really the main day that flags would be lowered to half staff, and then until noon. But after 9/11, Congress added more annual observances for peace officers, Memorial Day, and then Patriot Day, which is September 11th. They added Firefighters Memorial Day in October, National Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day in December. So Congress added some. I should note, too, that in some cases, changes to the flag code sort of were preceded by practices at the states. The flag code has not been amended very often. And in many cases, the amendments that have been made have been preceded by practices that were already going on in the state. So, for example, it was amended in 2007 to include fallen military service members, but by then governors in Wisconsin and elsewhere had already been doing that. Earlier this year, Congress passed the Honoring Hometown Heroes Act, which calls for police, firefighters, or emergency workers to be honored with flags lowered to half staff. Wisconsin had already been doing that for a long time.
And Michelle, as we start to wrap up, have there been times when flags being lowered or not being lowered has led to controversy or debate?
Yes, there have been. And I can give you a few examples
sure.
of that. In 2013, for example, when President Obama lowered flags on the death of former South African President Nelson Mandela, and Governor Walker, by the way, issued a separate executive order to that effect. Representative Jim Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin told an audience in Milwaukee that he didn't think that was appropriate, that under the flag code, the honor should be reserved for Americans,
so it was,
and not used to honor foreign leaders.
Okay, so it doesn't sound like he was saying Nelson Mandela doesn't deserve it. It said, I mean, foreign leaders die
right.
fairly
right.
frequently,
right.
And we don't do it other times.
That's right. And flag, but to be fair, flags have been lowered to half staff for other foreign leaders.
Hmm.
Other presidents have done that. No, Sensenbrenner was saying, I'm a big fan of Nelson Mandela, but I think this is a gesture that should be reserved for American dignitaries, not for foreign dignitaries.
Well, really interesting stuff, Michelle. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
That was Michelle Johnson, contributor to wiscontext.org, talking about her new piece for the site, Why and When Wisconsin Flies Flags at Half Staff. When we think of incarceration, state and federal prisons often come to mind first, but there are thousands of county and municipal jails across the country where people are held for a variety of reasons. Many are never convicted of a crime, but the experience still has a tremendous impact on them, their families, and their communities. Derek Jeffries is a professor of religion and philosophy at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. His most recent book is America's Jails, The Search for Human Dignity in an Age of Mass Incarceration. He joined us from our Green Bay studios. Derek, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Judith. Happy to be on.
Let's start off by defining jails versus prisons. How are they different?
Well, an important part of this book is to make that distinction. You know, we sometimes talk about the jail and prison interchangeably, but a jail is a county institution, usually, not always, but in most places. And it's a place where you have most of the inmates who are pre-trial, so you can have anywhere from 60 to 80% of the people there are legally innocent. And this is really important because when I talk about jail conditions, sometimes people say you do the crime, you do the time, or something like that. And that's not really the case because most of the inmates in a jail haven't committed a crime yet. They haven't been convicted of a crime. A prison is either a state institution or a federal institution. And everybody in a prison is convicted. Mm-hmm. So that's really an important distinction that I try to make in this book.
That was actually very eye-opening for me because I had not thought about that distinction of who is actually there. What about how long people spend in either a prison or in a jail? I think we often think of jails as a very temporary thing, and sometimes it is, but sometimes people end up in jails for a lot longer time.
That's correct. I mean, they're supposed to be in jail just for about a year. That's the usual standard, but that's really not the case. People can be there a year, 2 years, 3 years, sometimes as their trial wears on. And I've taught some inmates. I teach in a jail in the prison system, and I've taught some inmates who have been there 2 or 3 years, which is really quite extraordinary.
Well, and I think that's also a really important point, is that there are people who are waiting for their day in court, but they're waiting at home or they're waiting on some kind of release program. So who are the people who are in jail for a year, 2 years, 3 years while they're waiting for a court date?
Well, when you enter a jail, you'll find, the original purpose of the jail is to hold people who are not going to show up for trial or people who might be dangerous. And there are people like that in the jail. No one would deny that. But what you find in a jail when you enter it is, first of all, a lot of poor people. I mean, a lot of people who simply can't afford a bail. When you're arrested, a judge will tell you have to pay a certain amount of money in order to stay out of jail. And there are an awful lot of poor people who just don't simply have that money at all. In Chicago, where I did a lot of my research, you have to pay 10% of your bail, and so people might be able to afford that. In Brown County in Wisconsin, where I live, you have to pay 100% of the bail. So a lot of poor people simply can't pay that money. And so you'll find a lot of those people in the jail. And the other population, very sadly, and this is a difficult issue, are people suffering from mental illness. People end up in the jail system who don't have any resources, don't have any insurance, and they end up doing something on the street and they end up in the jail. So those two populations, you find a lot of people in those populations in the jail system.
And I think prison definitely conjures up a certain image, but jail might sound like a better place, an easier place to be. You just mentioned the Cook County Jail in Chicago, where you spent quite a bit of time doing some research. Can you describe for us some of the conditions? I know you could talk for hours about this, but some of the conditions that you found at Cook County Jail and heard about from both inmates and from people working there.
Well, you find really awful conditions in this country in both jails and prisons. But in fact, sometimes I've talked to inmates who had worse experiences in jails than prisons. So it's important that you point that out. And I did spend time in the Cook County Jail. Things are the sheriff down there is trying to make things better. But when I was there, conditions were pretty awful. So you find really awful sanitary conditions. I mean, you find sewage in some jails, just going down the in the halls of the jail, and terrible food and rodents and things like that. But you also find a great deal of violence, and it's inmate on inmate violence, and it's also staff violence. This is something that's difficult, really, to talk about. And I'm not in my book. I'm not here to condemn all corrections officers, anybody like that, but it's important to recognize that there is a considerable amount of staff violence in our jail system. And so you'll find that. And the last thing that I discovered is this lack of mental health care and medical care. And with such a large population of people suffering from mental illness, this is really can be a disaster. So I think that the conditions in our jail system are really bad. Now, there are exceptions. There are people who run a relatively decent jail. But if you think about, we have 3,200 jails in the United States, over 700,000 people a day on any given day in jails. 12 million people go through the jail system annually. And a lot of people go through institutions that are pretty awful.
You talked, Derek, about people coming into the jail system and often being assessed for mental health issues by people who are not equipped and not trained to be able to do those assessments. But even people who come in with a diagnosis, often with medication, they even have a hard time continuing their treatment, even keeping access to the medications that they've been prescribed and come in with.
That's entirely right. As you said, sometimes the assessment isn't good at all. We just have a big shortage of psychiatrists and psychologists and trained nurses to assess people when they walk in the door. So the assessment can be really quite poor, perfunctory. But even somebody who does come in with some kind of condition, they may not get their medications for a couple of days. And you know, if you're on a psychotropic medication, this can be really a real disaster. And sometimes the jail wants to put you on another medication because it's cheaper than the one you're on. And so this really creates a lot of problems. If you're suffering from some kind of mental disorder and you don't have medication, it's really bad for you. And it causes problems for the staff, too. I mean, you talk to staff people who really deal with this on a daily basis. So this is a big problem in the jails.
We're talking with Derek Jeffries right now. He's a professor of religion and philosophy at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. His research focuses on ethics and violence, and he's written books on torture and solitary confinement. His most recent book is America's Jails, The Search for Human Dignity in an Age of Mass Incarceration. And Derek, I want to talk about dignity right now. You focus a lot on how jails don't preserve and in many cases actively degrade the dignity of the people who are incarcerated. I think it might be a natural question for people to have with all the many very concrete problems that you list in your book. Why focus on something kind of as amorphous as dignity?
I'm a philosopher and a philosopher of religion. And so when I write books, I try to focus on some of the philosophical, the religious issues related to whatever topic I'm looking at. And dignity has been a central topic in the work I do because I think moral concepts are important. The way we treat people is important to all of us. And the idea of dignity that I talk about here is that people have value just because they're a person. It's really a simple but important idea. You don't get your value from your parents or from society or from any kind of community. And the thing that's important, too, is that you can't lose that dignity even if you do something awful. And some people that I teach, they feel like they've lost their value. And it's important to have them recognize that that's not true and it can't be true. No one can really lose her value no matter what she does. So that's the view of dignity that I want to defend in this book. And I think it means that we don't treat people in certain ways. A person has a certain value. And a thing has a certain value, and we don't treat persons like we do things. That's a basic distinction that I try to offer in this book.
Going back to the fact that a lot of people who end up in jail either are found innocent or charges are dropped, and so they never actually go on to being convicted and sentenced, you talk about how being locked up once, whether guilty or not, how they can really start a spiral for people financially and in other ways. Can you give us a little sense of what that's about?
Well, when you're in jail, you can't, you have difficulty perhaps paying your rent because you can lose your job. If you're particularly in any kind of subsidized housing, you can lose that subsidized housing. So you can lose your job, you can lose your rental situation. And you become estranged often from your family members, or separated from your family members. If you're a mother or father, you are then taken away from your children. And it's a very painful experience to not be able to see your children. And you also, a lot of people don't know this, but in many jails, you get assessed all kinds of fees, fees for being there and in the jail, $20, $30 a day for the time you spent in the jail. And even if you're found not guilty of a crime, you're going to have to pay those fees. And so if you think about what we said earlier, a year, 2 years, 3 years, that's a lot of money. And I'm presented with a bill after I leave, and that can really be detrimental to my credit rating and all kinds of other things.
Right. You said that actually often gets turned over to a collection agency, which then damages credit, which can impact being able to get housing or, say, buy a vehicle.
Absolutely. And if you're trying to get a new job, if you're trying to get a job and you have a bad credit rating, you're trying to get a loan, having this big bill here in Wisconsin, it comes from Madison, can really be detrimental to your life. One example that I describe in the book is everyone knows about Ferguson and the unrest in Ferguson. But part of that unrest had to do with the fact that you had this cycle. A lot of people were coming in and out of the jail, and the city was using that as a source of revenue. And sadly, this is not uncommon in the United States for municipalities to use the jail system as a source of revenue for different things. This is a huge problem for me in the United States.
Well, Derek, thank you so much for sharing your research with us. Really interesting.
Well, thank you, Judith.
Derek Jeffries is the author of the book America's Jails, The Search for Human Dignity in the Age of Mass Incarceration. On this 242nd Independence Day, we celebrate our victory over the British and the founding of a new nation. But just because we had a bit of a dust-up 2.5 centuries ago doesn't mean that we can't feel for them as they weather a crisis. I'm speaking, of course, of the great carbon dioxide shortage of 2018. It turns out that carbon dioxide is most commonly a byproduct of fertilizer factories. And in a stroke of bad luck, a large number of those plants in Britain are closed right now for repairs or because of technical failures. Plus, imports of fertilizer mean less domestic production overall. And two of the items that rely on CO2 for production are beer and crumpets. It may seem dire, but forecasts are that fertilizer production will pick up in August and more CO2 will be available shortly after. So while July may be rough for our cousins across the pond, a brighter, tastier future is within sight. We can only hope that they can get through this with a stiff upper lip. Well, coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. And then we talk with one Wisconsin small business owner who's making a difference in the lives of her local senior citizen communities by helping them access technology. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.